Today's guest is Susan Sons, who has been the main teacher and director of the New York School of Homeopathy since 1998. She has studied with many of the masters in the field and was awarded a homeopathic master clinician diploma, is naturally certified CCH and internationally certified IHC. Susan regularly publishes articles for national journals, including special presentations for hpathy.com. She has served on the National Board of the Council for Homeopathic Education and as the president of the New York State Homeopathic Association. Currently, she is serving on the board of the Association for International Homeopathic Certification, and she's a member of that group's steering committee. Susan is a well-known member of the international community of classical homeopaths and has conducted several highly respected homeopathic provings. In her teachings, Susan includes her own clinical case studies, which serve to illuminate remedy pictures while reinforcing homeopathic philosophy. She holds very high standards on homeopathic education while infusing her teachings with humor and sensitivity. I hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangouts. Today, we get to hang out with Susan Sons in New York, New York. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to have you on. And it looks like you spend some of your time in Jamaica as well. You get to hang out in all the cool places.
Yeah, I spend actually now most of my time in Jamaica.
Do you? Which is really such a hard life.
And now I do seminars down there. My students come down.
I saw on your website and I'm like,
twice a year.
That's a hard arm twist. Yeah. I'm going to go to Jamaica. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know.
I must.
It's great. So yeah, it's fun. Great place to live. But you live in a warm place.
Yes, yeah, too warm. I'd like it to be a little bit cooler. I'm more of a sulfury type and don't really like the heat too much. So Susan, how were you first introduced to homeopathy?
Homeopathy, I think, sort of started when I was little. In fourth grade, I was thinking about this because I've heard you ask other people, but I think it really started in fourth grade when I read a biography for kids about Louis Pasteur. And all the biography was all about how he was turned into the doctor and researcher that he became because of rabies. And it was like a really scary story about people being bitten by these rabid animals and dying. And that's what propelled him into the world of medicine. So I think that was when I started saying, oh, I want to be something like a medical inventor. That's what I thought. So I went to college for physical therapy originally, but I didn't do it. I didn't finish it. I was only there one semester and then I switched to liberal arts because I just couldn't bear the thought of cutting up a cadaver. So I got out while the going was good. But I knew I always knew there was something I wanted to do. And then weirdly, I got into the arts. So I did that for quite a long time. And finally, I was someone who always read about natural medicine. I was weirdly giving advice to everybody. People would always call me. I had no right to be called or to be giving advice, but I was doing it. I had one child at the time and, I was doing everything natural and so on. And finally, someone said to me, why don't you become a naturopath? So I thought, oh. Because I don't know if you know what it's like to make a living as an artist, but it's not easy.
So it's like, I would fail epically because I do not have an arty bone in my body.
Well, it's not easy. It was like, yes, I should do something else. And I looked up naturopathy and the only thing that interested me was homeopathy. Even though I didn't really know what homeopathy was. It's like one of those things, it just jumps out at you. And I was like, no, this is all I want to do. So I called up Robert Stewart, who was at the time was running the New York School of Homeopathy. And I said to him, I think I want to study homeopathy. And he said, oh, I have a class going on tonight. Come on over. And I said, I don't know anything. He said, jump in. The water's fine. And that was the biggest green light for me. And honestly, doors just kept opening. So Robert had me help him organize the school a couple years later. And then he decided to move to California. So he said, do you want the school? And it was like, great. Now I can turn it into how I think it should really be running. So that's really how it started. It wasn't some miraculous cure I'd experienced or even anyone else. Long before, I was one of those, as he liked to call them, homeopathic virgins. when I get into his class. I'd never even taken arnica.
I was one of those too.
Were you? Yeah.
Yeah, we're actually quite rare.
They are rare. That you, something just screams at you, right? And you decide to do it. I have to be honest, that's really how it happened. It was, felt like chance, but more like, you know, being hit over the head by chance, you know. So
that philosophy, I fell in love with that. I fell in love with the idea of homeopathy before I saw the magic, and then I was already head over heels, but that made it.
Exactly. It makes so much sense, right? And so that was how I responded to it. It was like, oh, yeah, this is it. And I remember Robert saying something else interesting. He said, when you study homeopathy, you're either going to be someone who, yeah, does it for a while and then quits, or you're going to be someone who is reading the books while sitting on the toilet.
Yep.
And that always hit me. I remember, oh my God, all those years ago before the computers and all that, and we were, you know, we would Xerox. It was really funny, that kind of hunger for information. But I love that. I love that when I see that in my students, and I do. Certain students, you can tell they're going to be homeopaths because the hunger for information is there. And I remember it so well. I remember that, oh my God, another article, you know, and you'd get to read it.
And now we're so spoiled for choice. There has been an absolute explosion since COVID in new homeopathy books coming out. I think all these homeopaths that have had a book in them for a long time finally got to sit down and do some writing, whereas others were just busier than ever before. But it just really feels like there's a lot of new books that have come out recently.
A lot of information out there. And with computers, it's an unbelievable. And online, I mean, and people like you, you know, I mean, there's just so much out there.
Imagine having a homeopathy podcast in the 1990s, hey, or, you know, like even our beautiful movies that we have now, Just One Drop and reintroducing homeopathy that's coming out this year. And we really are spoiled for choice.
We really are. Yeah, we're very lucky. I tell that to my students when they complain about some of the reading and so on. I go, oh my God, you have no idea how easy it is for you now. And they don't even have to buy all the books we used to have to buy.
Yeah.
I don't regret it, but it was a lot of books. People send me emails offering me their books all the time because now everyone feels like they don't need books around. But the homeopathy books are great.
They really are. How could you? I have electronic versions and physical versions of, because sometimes I just want to cuddle them, okay? I have to confess, I do sometimes just cuddle my books. Is that weird? I don't care.
No, to actually read a book online, I find impossible. What's great about it is when you want to look up one remedy, right?
Yes, the control F function.
It's so great. But if you're really going to read someone's book, I can't do it electronically. I can't use a Kindle. I've read authors that I like on Kindles and not enjoyed their books and thought, is it the book or is it the Kindle? So it is different.
It is. I have to say, I have full access to the Radar Opus program now, and there are thousands of books in there. So quite a few of the books I'll often pull up there and I'll use the control F function. I'll quickly search for a keyword to try and see what remedy it is. But, you know, when it comes to the actual reading, that's when I'll grab the book out. But it's so handy having all those. But, you know, like the Secret Lanthanides book, I bought it, the physical version the other day, but I've got the electronic version already in, Radar Opus.
It's great to have it in a program. I don't know. It's great to have these books in the program so you can look up the remedies easily. But to sit down and read them, it's wonderful to have them in book form.
It is.
Yeah, I'm happy to have both.
And I do like highlighting and underlining in my books as well. I'm not precious about them. To me, that book's been loved when it's got dog-eared corners and lines. And it's a book that's been loved.
It's really true.
Yeah. Now, the New York School of Homeopathy, I didn't realize it's the oldest and the largest continually operating homeopathic college in the United States.
So I'm not sure about the largest anymore, but it is, I'm very sure, the longest running, continuously running, you know, even COVID. I mean, nothing actually stopped the school from when Robert started it in 1990. And it was like around 97, 98 when Robert went to California, because I remember he was in California for 9/11. So he definitely had gone before that. So that was when he turned the school over to me. And I loved Robert as a teacher, so there's nothing about Robert. But to make it a more stronger curriculum, something that would repeat every year for the foundation year, have some sort of an organic growth for the other years. And yeah, it was great. So for many years, we were a four-year school. And a couple of years ago, we decided people wanted to do things faster. The whole world is moving faster. So we turned into a three-year school. And there's more weekends and more extra classes and many more hours per year now. So that's pretty much how we've evolved. But the basic idea is the foundation year, we are learning the history and the philosophy and the, you know, the most famous remedies, the remedies that everyone needs to know. And we start talking about what I call groupings, and because it's one of our ways that we work at the school. So we start talking about groupings. We learn the periodic table sort of via Jan Schulten and then Rajan Sankaran and so on. But of course, we concentrate on the well-known mineral remedies. In the winter, we do minerals, and we concentrate for months on the well-known mineral remedies in the first year. And then year after year, we just keep expanding that. So the groupings starts a little in the first year, but I start them on Kingdoms first class. And every session that we have, the homework includes at least one mineral, one animal, and one plant remedy. And then in the winter, after they've been with me a couple of months, we start talking about nozodes and sarcodes. And then I try to make sure all of these kinds of remedies are included in every session of homework so that they get used to, they have to explain to me why it feels like a mineral remedy or why it feels like a plant remedy or an animal remedy. So they get used to that idea, because those are the biggest groupings. Then we start talking about the calcarea grouping, or the, I try to get them used to this idea of grouping remedies. I think it's easier.
It's definitely easier
to do that. It's easier to learn it that way. And it's easier to see if you can tell, first of all, that someone's in the mineral kingdom, right? And then you're listening and you're listening, you go, oh God, this really sounds like it could be a calcarea remedy. It just starts getting easier. So I try to get them used to that in the first year, because in the second year, we really go for it. And we learn mammals as a grouping, and we learn snakes as a grouping, and spiders and acids and gemstones. And we try to stick with groupings from there on, because if you can recognize them, it makes it easier to pick a remedy. That's my belief. And it seems to work in the clinic. Well, also, by the way, you know, we have done a number of provings at the school. And I like to use those to demonstrate a number of things. First of all, I think provings prove that homeopathy works. That's what I really like about them, you know. It's amazing when you see the stuff come out in a proving and you realize, oh my God, it really works. I don't know why. I always say to my students, don't ask me why, because there's no why. I can't explain it, but I can explain to you that it does work and I can show you. So as we get into clinic work, we talk about it in the first year quite a bit, but we seriously get into this idea of the source. So the source of the remedy that a person needs, to me, is very important if you can get the person to tell you that source. And that, to me, is the most magical of all the ways of working with homeopathy. And I think everyone sees it once in a while, but we really concentrate on trying to make that happen. So I call it experiential homeopathy because it's the experience of the source that people end up describing when they can go there. And if they can go there, that's what I call the true similimum, which is, I think, why I had suggested that that's what I would talk about, because I'm really, really interested in that profound remedy that changes people's lives. And in my experience, it's very often the remedy they use for the rest of their life. And it's fascinating, both the case taking and the result. It's almost unbelievable to see how people change. We all see this in homeopathy, don't get me wrong. And by the way, I teach repertory seriously, and we have three long weekends of acute work. And all of these things are important. I don't want to pretend any of this is not important in the world of homeopathy, but I'm just talking about this one special thing that I often talk about, which is this special remedy, this true similimum. which I think is found through getting the person to, talk from their unconscious mind. All this information that they've been, almost all the time people say to me, I don't know where that came from. And that's what I want to hear, because I don't know where that came from. To me, the perfect, or if someone says, starts laughing and says, oh my God, you must think I'm so crazy. And I think, yeah, that's great. It's perfect. Because I want people to be saying totally absurd things. Things that they're not planning on saying comes from the unconscious mind. It's so revealing. I don't know. An example I often will use is if someone's source or Trusamilimum was Cochinella. We call it ladybug here, but I think you call it ladybird, right?
Yeah.
The English countries tend to call it ladybird.
Yeah.
So if someone came to me whose Trusamilimum was Cochinella, then I would expect that from childhood, I don't know why, but I do think that we come into this world resonating with or relating to some source in nature. So it might be a plant, might be a mineral, might be an animal, that we will have some special resonance with that source. I mean, this is just the way I believe it. I'm not saying it's true. It's just the way I see it. And if that is true, and let's say someone comes into this world resonating with ladybird, ladybug, and I would assume that from childhood, that person is going to be noticing ladybugs in a very strong way. Might be afraid of them, might be in awe of them, might love them, might hate them, who knows? But every cartoon, and cartoons have ladybugs, right? So every cartoon is going to register in this kid's unconscious mind. And that nursery rhyme, ladybug, ladybug, fly away home, your house is on fire, your children are gone, this, right? They might have an irrational fear of fire and they don't know where it comes from. Just because that nursery rhyme went into their unconscious mind in a really strong way, right? I don't know why I'm gesturing back here for the unconscious mind, but I don't know where to gesture. So I think that everything, orange, polka dots, red, green plants, yellow plants, who knows, all this stuff is going to register over and over. And then if we're able to, in a homeopathic interview, unlock that unconscious information, it's amazing to see this come out. It's amazing once it starts, because once it starts, they can't stop. They are saying one absurd thing after another, which is why they laugh and say, I have people say, am I the craziest person you've ever talked to? I go, no, that's a pretty good contest.
I have people ask that all the time as well. And I almost, like, some people wear it like a badge of honor. I almost feel bad telling them, lady, you have no idea.
You have no idea.
But also at the same time, it's like for us, we don't see it as crazy. Like there's zero judgment from our side. We see it as the source putting itself into words, that subconsciousness trying to put itself into words, pictures, feelings, little snapshots to give us little glimpses of what it is. You know, that subconscious is like,
I often
get clients to like just close their eyes in clinics. I get them to ground themselves, just take deep breaths. And then I'll say, I want you to think of this thing that you've just said to me. What's the first word or picture or emotion or feeling or whatever that pops in your mind when you think about this thing? And sometimes you can get them to say that other people think it's a little bit weird, like, you know, but as you do that later on, it gets a little bit easier. But you're so right. I do that source. They carry it with them very often. I've told the story lots of times on the podcast. I'll never forget that lady I prescribed the blue morpho butterfly to. And she had long sleeves on, and she pulled up her sleeves. And she's like, when I told her the remedy that I'm going to give her, she said, you won't believe this. Pulled up her sleeves and there was a blue butterfly tattooed on her arm. And that's,
Of course.
A lot of people here in Australia with tattoos, they often do carry their source in a tattoo on them because it's something that resonates with them. And so they want to immortalize it on their skin.
No, it's true. It's true. I mean, we did that. We have an old falcon case. I mean, old meaning 20 years ago. And she turned around and had this huge bird tattooed, this beginning of a bird tattoo, a falcon on her lower back. And I was like, oh my God. So yeah, it's semi-conscious and unconscious. So when you really go with them, when you really get them going, it's amazing, isn't it, to listen to them? It's amazing. I also have a blue morpho case, and it was amazing how she could see through her hand. I mean, everything she said, in fact, she had, oh my God, it was such an amazing case because she had dreams that were like of being down in, and every time she told this dream, it was like all you could imagine was an ant farm. right? The way we used to have ant farms. And then when we found out that a lot of butterflies are brought down into the ant home, because when it's time for them to come out of the cocoon, there's that sticky fluid and the ants eat all the sticky fluid off of them, and that's how they unwrap. It was unbelievable.
I didn't know that.
Lovely case, beautiful cases. I mean, the source cases are amazing. And, you know, it really doesn't matter what kingdom, because when I teach, you know, I try to teach, I call it the big ideas, right? Especially in the first year, I teach the big ideas, groupings. I call it kingdoms, groupings, and big ideas. That's how I teach. And so I think it's easier, first of all, if you're going to learn a remedy like pulsatilla, to think of it as a plant and think about the words that a plant is going to say, stuck, among other things, because they can't go anywhere. So anyhow, when I teach pulsatilla, I always put my hand up and say, well, it's called the wind flower. And that's because the wind comes this way and pushes it this way and this way and this way. And that's why one of our big symptoms in pulsatilla is yielding, because the wind flower yields to the wind. That's called a signature symptom. So this is in the first year I'm teaching this. I had a client once who needed pulsatilla, and she actually put her elbow on my desk and said, I feel like I'm in a windstorm and the wind is pushing me this way. And I thought, how could you come up with my gesture?
That's pretty spectacular.
It's amazing. I mean, we use the hashtag endlessly fascinating because every case, I know you feel the same way. Every case is fascinating. Every case is amazing. I learn from every student, every case, every class I teach. I learn so much. So it just never stops, just keeps going.
That really is the message I'm trying to get across with this podcast. And the reason why I started it in the first place is because I want clients to understand that we just want to help them. All of them are fascinating and interesting. And there's nothing that they can say that we will judge them for or will think is strange. In fact, the stranger it is, the better. And I just hope that people will listen to this and go, okay, it's actually fine for me to say this. And since the podcast, it's been wonderful because even my clients will have opened up more towards me. And they're like, I know in the podcast you say that you like all the weird stuff, so I'm going to tell you this. And it's actually made my prescribing so much easier.
Right.
You know, if people can understand
it.
Yeah, it's just be open with us, like let it all out, let the crazy out. It helps us to help you more. And we don't think anything of it. Like we are just trying to find that source.
That's right. And it's interesting because another thing that Robert Stewart said years ago was don't get carried away with the opera. And so I try to explain to my students, it's also really interesting to hear about someone's divorce or whatever, but you won't ever get the remedy that way. It's just the opera. Enjoy it for 2 minutes, but let it go. Don't let the person keep going, because that's the conscious mind. And they're not going to give us the remedy, the profound remedy with the conscious mind. It's all going to come from some other place. So yeah, it makes case taking a lot of fun, I'd say. And I love it when they say, do I sound crazy? Oh my God. Or, oh, I've never said or thought this in my whole life. And it's like, great. At least now I know we got there. And it gives you confidence.
And people will say that they've been to like a psychologist for 10 years, but they've shared things with us they've never shared with anyone else. And I think that space that we hold, but also the way that we question them, I think we're always going like the step behind, or what's behind that? What's the reason behind that? What happened before that? So I do think
they're always surprised, don't you think? They're always surprised by our questions.
Yeah.
Because they're used to something else, especially with doctors, right? And when you go after that chief complaint, because they'll probably say things that will lead you to helping them lead them somewhere else, they're not used to that, because normally the doctor's like, oh yeah, they're, you know, they don't have the time. So I think the patients are always surprised. I had a young boy the other day, 16-year-old, and he was so surprised but happy with what had gone on, because he expected something much, I think, grimmer or more serious. So it's great. It's really fun. It's a great
question. It's what's
that? No, I was just saying, it's a great world we work in.
I can see that in you as well. I think as a homeopath, we need to keep that sense of wonder. I think that's really important.
Yes.
Like having that sense of wonder, like always staying a little child in your mind, like being interested and intrigued and questioning, why is that? But then kind of just going with the magic as well. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It is magical.
It is magical, but I try not to say that too often. because it's the biggest complaint we get, I think, is about sort of the magical approach. So anyhow, what's your question?
With all the suppression these days, all the medications, all the Wi-Fi, all the injections, all the stuff going around everywhere, do you find it a bit trickier to find the true simulamum now than you did in the 1990s?
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I think I'm more clear about how to do it now. So no, I find it easier now. I would say maybe the first case I ever took in clinic when I was absolutely not knowing anything, but it turned out I think it was a source case and I was like blown away. I think it was more by chance before. I mean, it was what I always wanted. I do think it felt like it was a little more haphazard. And that's why, even though I was running a school, I've always studied with other people as well, because there's so much to learn. And I've learned from other people how to articulate what I do. I don't know how else to put that. But other teachers have improved my articulation and my understanding of how deliberate it is. I don't think it was always that deliberate on my part, or that I knew how to be deliberate about it. So I find it easier now. Suppression. In the clinic, to be honest, in the school clinic, I try not to take cases where there is a lot of medication involved, because I don't want my students to be disappointed in a difficult case to take, and then also a lack of a response. So I am a little fussier in my school clinic. And I try to get people who are, you know, on either small amounts of medication or things like insulin, that's fine. Or if they're on thyroid medicine, I don't want them to go off these things because their bodies will have a bad response. And I don't find they're really suppressive. But hormones, I find, are the most suppressive. I think they're the biggest problem. I actually find psychotropic drugs don't really get in the way, because people who come to us and they're on them, the drugs aren't working. So they're not feeling them, right? And so I find they don't really get in the way. They're not doing a very good job of suppressing. Whereas hormones, the pill, is to me the worst. Something that is telling a woman's body not to ovulate. How can we rebalance that person if they're on the pill? So it's on my intake form. Are you taking any form of hormones? If people, okay, so I have patients who've been, you know, they have Crohn's disease or whatever, and they're on some steroids. And then the hope is that, you know, you wean them down. I think that people's vital forces are so strong that despite some of the suppression, it works out just fine. I don't think that's true with hormonal birth control. I think that you might get the case, but they won't feel the remedy. And I do think it's harder to get the case. Now, not everybody can go to the source. Unfortunately, our jobs would be way easier if everyone could do it. But what I tell my patients is, I'm really looking for an amazing remedy for you. And if I don't hit that, we'll keep going. You know, so you'll take a remedy, you'll feel it. You're always going to get close, pretty much, right? So I say to them, you'll feel the remedy, things will change, and then I'll take your case again. And it's one of my favorite things about homeopathy. It took me a while to get to this place, but whoa, I can retake a case. And that relaxes me. So that I have to tell you, when I started homeopathy, and this is a while back, but when I started, I thought clinic classes, they reminded me of game shows, like zing, you know, it's this remedy or that remedy. You know, people were yelling out, it's calcarea, it's pulsatilla. And I felt very intimidated by that as a student, because to me, I wasn't processing that quickly. And I didn't think anyone else should be either at the time, right? So then the first thing I told myself was, take your time. So I learned to take my time. And I allow at least 3 hours per patient. And frankly, I like to have time even after that, just in case, because if someone has to keep going, or if I think I'm going to get there, but I need to keep going, that's what I want. So I'm very generous with my scheduling, not for follow-ups. Follow-ups, I think, are quite easy and zing, zing, zing. But for a first case, so I try to do my follow-ups and then I'll do a case and hopefully have space beyond that time in case I need it. But the other thing that I do is when I start a case and I get, I don't know about other people, but you know, I get like, wow, I hope I'm going to be able to find the right remedy, you know. I get nervous. The more serious the pathology, the more nervous I get, right? And so what I tell myself right in the beginning of every case is, you can retake this case. Stop worrying. You can do it again. You can do it 2 times. You can do it 3 times. You can do it as many times as you need to, if they're willing. If I don't get a reaction from a remedy with a person, I retake the case, no charge, just retake it. And then I usually see, oh, yeah, that's why they didn't react. And I see the right remedy. Or I'll do it, you know, I'll do it. I'll do it again. I'll do it again. Keep trying. Because some people don't go to the source as beautifully as others. Mm. They give you a lot, right? You know this. They give you, you got a million symptoms, right? From one patient, you can get a million symptoms. You totally see the kingdom. You see the grouping, right? You might see animal and you might see insect, but then it's like, which insect? And so you have to keep going at it until they finally, as I say, spill the beans. So that was for me very reassuring. And I try to reassure my students that way. You can retake the case. You can always retake the case. Not a problem. Sometimes in clinic, we would do it the next day. And so I think it's very reassuring. This started with suppression, with medicine. If I get the impression that that's what's going on from a psychotropic drug, then I talk to them. But if some people seem closed and they're not ready to do it, then I pick what we all call the well-indicated remedy. I put them on it. And, you know, some things are going to happen, right? It's like, oh, I think I'm sleeping a little better. And, you know, this kind of thing. Fine. Now come back in. You know, once you've felt that, come back in and let's try it again. And that's how I do it. It's only hormones. It's really only, I hate to say it, you know, basically it's female hormones that concern me. The birth control. And then, of course, hormone replacement therapy. These things that are meant to change a woman's body, I think are very difficult. Whether or not they're suppressive, I think it's hard for homeopathy to get through them.
That's where I was kind of meaning as well. So if you, because I've definitely had the experience of clients, especially when they've had the implant on, you know, the rod, it actually change their personality. And so when you are then taking the case as a classical single remedy constitutional prescriber, where you're trying to find that one remedy, you're then, the picture that you're prescribing on is different to their true constitutional remedy. So this is where I've got a little, in Afrikaans we say, I get the clanky do it. I don't like, that's when we say, okay, the source remedy, all that. But the person that you're seeing, this is actually not that person. That is a picture that you're seeing. And I saw this with a powerful example with a client of mine who, after she had the rod removed, complete personality change. So then it's like, well, that is not, you're not prescribing on that person's constitution. You're prescribing on a drug picture. They are, they're not prepared to come off that. The picture that you're seeing of them on that medication, on that rod, is different to their true similimal, their true person, who they are. So that's why I sometimes, when I have clients who are on loads of different medications, I prescribe with a picture that's in front of me. And eventually, once we get some of these layers out, you might see the true similimum under that. But I sometimes feel that, especially with some of our young, like our listeners, the new homeopaths, they might get a little bit frustrated thinking, oh, I haven't found this person's true similimum. But sometimes you actually just need to prescribe for what you're seeing in front of you. But I also like that you in your clinic are having patients there who are not on that many different medications, because as a new student, if you were to see what we see in clinic, of really chronic suppressive cases, you would probably not finish your studies because it can actually be sometimes really, really depressing. I have a client at the moment who is on 10 milligrams of steroids every single day for the past 30 years. And all I'm doing is just trying to deal every day with the picture that's in front of me. She emailed me this morning, literally just before I go off the call with you, saying she's down to 5 milligrams now. So all we are doing is just managing the case.
That's right.
As
that's right.
Going. And if some,
and it's so some exciting.
For 30 years, you really don't know what's under all of that. So if you are not finding that true simulamum or that true source medicine straight away, just stick with it. I mean, that's always our goal, right? Is to get to that simulamum. I found mine in 2012 myself when I went to a couple of homeopaths. The remedies they gave me didn't help. Somebody said to me, have you worked out your miasmatic remedy? And I literally went through our class handout and I'm like, oh, I matched that one. And, you know, that's been my remedy ever since. For the past 10 years, that's been the remedy that will always get me back to balance. I've had some other remedies. So I've seen other homeopaths and I've been prescribed a remedy and that kind of was what I needed in that point. So that's why I sometimes am a little bit, and like just before this consult, my daughter was here drawing and I found myself being a bit irritable and I know I'm premenstrual at the moment. So I had a dose of sepia. So sepia was my constitutional in that moment, whereas my other one that I've used for 10 years, it wouldn't have done the same as what sepia did for me right now. But at my core, I do know my constitutional, my source remedy. So that's why sometimes, I mean, that's always our goal, right? To get to that source medicine, but
it is. I think that's the goal. And I don't know. I don't want anyone to think that I don't do what I would call regular homeopathy, because of course I do a lot of it, because a lot of my patients can't go to the source. So I'm not going to send them away. It's not because, not even because they're on medication, they just can't. They're, you know, like, well, it hurts. Yes, it hurts bad, you know. They can't give me anything that I can help them go
and
to
maybe
the
they're in a situation like a Staphylococcus, you know, that's in an abusive relationship and she literally can't leave her relationship.
Yeah, that's what I call a well-indicated remedy. You know, when you see someone, you know some of the history, you know the symptoms, you can look them up and use your big ideas or the repertory or however you do it and give a good remedy. And they will feel it. And then you keep going because the goal, the ultimate goal is for this really amazing remedy that is one's true simulamum. But it doesn't mean you're not doing the other kind of homeopathy. I call it a toolbox. At school, I always say to my students, well, we have a toolbox and the repertory is one of those tools, but don't stop there. As we know, some homeopaths think, if it's not in the repertory, if you're not doing repertory work, it's not homeopathy. But Hahnemann never used a repertory. That was a gift to him, but he didn't care. He didn't use it. He called it the medical art, right? And it's important to remember that it was artful to him. And so it needs to be artful for all of us. Whether we're giving well-indicated remedies, acute remedies, or whatever, it's still an art, right? But when you can go deeper and give someone a life-changing, profound remedy, then what's better than that? It's amazing. It's amazing. So, yeah, I mean, you get all types. You get all types in your clinic. I will say when I have someone on birth control, you know, if they mark that off on the intake form, I spend about a half hour with them telling them why I don't think homeopathy is going to work. And I don't charge them anything. If they still want to do it, I do what I can. Yeah. But it's very hard to say to a woman, it's not like a psychotropic drug, right? Or even a steroid, to say to someone, gee, we're going to wean you off that birth control. They're not going to do it. They want the easiest and the surest birth control. And I get that. But I also explain to them why I don't think it's going to work. And I don't want them to waste their money unknowingly by coming to me and thinking something profound is going to happen when it's not. It's not. If you're taking something that is changing your physiology as a woman, I don't see how homeopathy, which is always meant to rebalance you, how it could work. So I just explain that to them. And if they do want to carry on, and then some people say, well, maybe I'll consider going off the birth control, then I say, that's great. You know, this will go well. Acute remedies, I think, often will work despite all that. But I don't think anything really profound is going to happen. So I don't even allow it in the clinic with birth control because I can't, you know, I don't want to be guessing with my students. Is it because of the birth control? Is it because it's the wrong remedy? Is it, you know, you don't want that. Mm. So we like to see real change in the clinic, and we do. And I mean, the clinic, I have to say, in the school works so well because it's always me and a student. And I let the student go as long as he or she can go interviewing the person. They understand that my goal in clinic is to get that patient a good remedy, mm. right? So I let them take the case as long as they're comfortable. But then as I see them kind of perhaps, you know, playing. Going in circles or whatever, I sort of shamelessly jump in mm. and start taking it so that the patient will give this kind of information, this unconscious information. And then when you see it happen, it's so amazing. Very often the student can do it, don't get me wrong, mm. but I'm just explaining that that's why we're together, because I don't want that patient to go away without a remedy, a good remedy. And so if I see we're not getting there, not because the patient doesn't look able to do it, but because we're not getting there, then I jump in and make it happen. So the clinic, and then the student follows the patient up once a week for years. And the student writes an email report and we talk about it and we see them again in clinic and so on. So there's a really nice long-term momentum that goes on in our clinic. It's really lovely. And it gives graduated students an excuse to come back to class because it's their patient that we're seeing as a, for a follow-up and so on. So it works really nicely. And we have reports that go on sometimes, you know, 10 years or more.
That's the best. So your program is 3 years now. Can people join in at any time, or do you have a specific intake every year, or how does that work?
We start the new class in November every year.
Oh, okay.
The clinic class starts in September every year. Mm. So starting in the second year, you go right into the clinic, but then we have special classes for these groupings, mm. you know, the animal groupings and the plant mm. groupings and so on. But the clinic, I have my second year students go right in as observers. Amazing. And then they become senior clinic members and they're taking cases. Great. So that's how it works. The first year, you're pretty much observing, unless you're a special student. Then I'm happy to let you take a case.
Well, not one of us, like that were homeopathy virgins, but one of these incredible mums that have been prescribing their whole life. And then they start right. to study homeopathy and they pretty much, like I actually have one of my staff who's also a nurse. It's been, I call her honorary homeopath. She's just studying at the moment, but she was pretty much a homeopath before she started. Yeah. Susan, where can people get hold of you? So your website's nyhomeopathy.com, but anything yeah. else that you want to share with them, or in you're on Instagram?
Well, Instagram and Facebook. And the nyhomeopathy.com website, first of all, explains a lot, has our provings on there. And also there's obviously an email option in the website mm. too, because it's simply info@nyhomeopathy.com is the email. Mm.
Amazing.
That's the way to get in touch with us.
Thank you so much for your time today. Was there any last little bits that you wanted to share just before we finish off?
Right. I think that this special remedy that you and I were talking about, I think that we've been doing it. I think Hahnemann was interested in it. You know, I think that this is really what homeopathy is based on, which is why provings are so successful. We had one person who was an amazing prover, and all he could talk about, I don't know if you know, but flies lay their eggs in excrement, right? So all he could talk about was shit and poop and all these things. And he wanted to jump into dumpsters. It was an amazing response he had to 130C. And his wife got so fed up with him that she said to him, she had not taken the remedy. He took the remedy. And his wife said, I know what you're proving. You're proving maggot. Can you imagine? You know, the larval fly. How could she know that? So the provings themselves are so amazing. And they prove that this is source work, you know? And so it's the language of the source is what I am looking for, and in order to get these profound life-changing results. So that's, you know, I just thought I'd repeat that.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for your time today. It was lovely to connect with you.
Thank you. And, yeah, really nice to meet you.
Look forward to speaking with you soon.
Great. Thanks so much.